BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the programme and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Anne Scott-James, Dillis Powell, Dennis Norden, and Frank Muir. Round one tries to test their vocabulary. 2 marks if they get the meanings of these words roughly right. Beginning with Dillis Powell. Dillis, what is jurisprudence?
Something to do with the law, isn't it?
Yes.
It's the prudence of the law, the wisdom of the law. It's the science of law.
That's all right. 2 marks. Hold on. Dennis Norden, what is monomania?
Well, it's what I used to get reproached with in my youth on Saturdays nights. You've got a one-track mind, which is monomania. Mono, one, mania, being having a complex about, one. Like people who say, take two, they're rather small, they have a complex about you to only taking one. There are those people.
I think that's good enough, Dennis, too. It's being insane on one subject only, or having your mind obsessed with a single idea, like thinking you're Napoleon and refusing to believe you're not.
You mean there are people who doubt it?
Yes, it's been one of my sorrows. Anne Scott-James, what is lanolin?
Oh, lanolin is a delicious, rich, fatty substance.
Yes.
Which you get from sheep.
Mm-hmm.
And I know all about this because when I was 25 and realised how old I was looking for my age, I used to try a delicious, rich ointment full of lanolin.
What did it
now do? I'm a little bit more than 25. I realise it's too late and not worth trying anymore. I've given up lanolin.
Oh, that's terribly sad. I'd awfully like to give you 3 marks for that, Anne, but I can't. 2, anyway. Thank you.
What is a port? P-O-O-R-T. Port.
Port is a man who writes poems, my dear.
Won't do.
Won't do?
No.
That's good, isn't it? Port.
The cave? It's a mine.
It's the opposite to starboard. On the veldt. When you're on the veldt, you don't know which way to push the wily beast. You say, port your helm. Starboard, put. It's all that sort of thing.
Yes, of course.
I'll accept 1.5.
I'll give you one. It is, in fact, a narrow mountain pass in South Africa. It means a gate or a gateway. It's narrower than a neck, which means a mountain pass or col. Well, before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down, and then the 2 women members of the team, I hope, study their quotations throughout the rest of the programme. And at the end, I ask them for the source of those 2 quotations. So, Dillis Powell and Frank Muir, here's your quotation. Someday I'll find you. And Anne, Scott, James and Dennis, yours is, how sharper than a serpent's tooth it is to have a thankless child. And at the end of the programme, I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their ideas of how these words came to be said or written. Now, round two is classical, questions about mythology. But 2 marks say briefly what you know, if anything, about the following. Beginning with Dillis Powell. Dillis, what were griffins? G-R-I-F-F-I-N-S, or if you're very superior, you might spell it G-R-Y-P-H-O-M-S.
They were kind of hybrid objects. They were animals which had the bodies of lions, leopards or tigers without stripes, and wings and beaks.
Yes.
Bird heads with beaks.
I think that's good enough. 2 marks. Dennis Norden. Dryads. D-R-Y-A-D-S.
They were nymphs.
Yes.
They were tree nymphs.
Yes, that's good enough.
Actually, if it was a willow tree, they would be drip dryads.
Oh. I can't possibly beat that. They were among various classes or orders of nymphs who were demigods who each looked after a certain bit of nature. There were naiads who were found in freshwater lakes and streams, and oreads in mountains and caves. And dryads were the spirits of the trees. And if they were hamadryads, they had a very unfortunate time because they were supposed to die when their particular tree died as well. They were quite fatally with it in that sense. Two marks. Anne Scott James. Who was Laocoon? L-A-O-C-O-O-N. Laocoon.
Oh, Laocoon was the very unfortunate man who was destroyed by serpents, who rose out of the sea, sent by Aphrodite, if I've got my goddess right.
Not quite the right
no,
job,
listen.
But never mind. The rest of the story is quite right.
He told the Trojans not to let the wooden horse into Troy.
Yes.
And then the serpents were sent out of the sea.
Absolutely right. He was the priest in Troy of Apollo. And Apollo was very angry, first of all, because his priest got married, which wasn't the done thing. And second, because he warned the Trojans not to let this enormous great wooden horse object into their walls. So that Apollo sent out of the sea these two serpents, and they not only strangled Laocoon, but...
Oh, with the children, too.
Two children, too, and there's a terrific statue of it all happening, which was found in Rome, dug up in about 1506. Two marks. Frank Muir, Cassiopeia.
A Greek, Jack.
Yes.
Figure from Greek mythology. A lady, at a guess. And I think she offended a god...
She
and
did.
Got changed into something.
Well, she did, but can you remember what she is now? And I'll give you some marks.
She's a star.
Yes, 1.5, I think, is fair. She was the wife of Cepheus, who was king of Ethiopia, and she said she was the most beautiful thing that there was, and even beautiful than those sea nymphs and nereids. And so the god of the sea, Poseidon, sent a flood and a horrible sea monster, and the only way of stopping the sea monster was to put... Cassiopeia's daughter, Andromeda, chain her to a sea rock so that the monster could gobble her up. But she was saved by Perseus.
She's a star as well, isn't
she? And then afterwards, both she and her mother became stars, which doesn't always happen in show business. Well, the next round's all about verse and poetry. I give each member of each team a quotation and ask them to complete it for the next line or two. Two marks if they can complete the quotation, and two more for correctly naming its source. Adelis Powell. But soon a wonder came to light that showed the rogues they lied. Stick to the rhyme with lied.
The dog it was that died.
Got it. Well done. Remember the author?
Goldsmith.
Yes, quite right. What happened to the man?
The man didn't die. He was all right. He was absolutely okay.
Three and a half. But soon a wonder came to light that showed the rogues they lied. The man recovered of the bite. The dog it was that died. It's Oliver Goldsmith's Elegy on the Death of a Mad Dog and the last verse. You did jolly well, did it? Dennis Norden. I am out of humanity's reach. I must finish my journey alone. Never hear the sweet music of speech. I start at the sound of my own.
This is Desert Island.
Yes.
I don't know how it goes on. It's Robinson... Well, it's not Robinson Crusoe, is it? It's the original of Robinson.
Yes.
So, Alexander Selkirk.
Yes.
I don't know, I can't remember who it's by.
Contemporary of Goldsmith.
Yeah.
Like the Villages.
Oh, the deserted... Cooper.
Yes. Yeah. Three, I think. Helped a bit there. I'm out of humanity's reach. I must finish my journey alone. Never hear the sweet music of speech. I start at the sound of my own. The beasts that roam over the plain, my form with indifference see, they are so unacquainted with man, their tameness is shocking to me. Supposed to be written by Alexander Selkirk, who was abandoned on a desert island and was the original for Robinson Crusoe. In fact, written by William Cooper. Anne Scott James. A frog he would a wooing go. Hey ho, says Rowley.
All I know it is a nursery rhyme.
Yes.
But I can't. Do we know the author? Anon, I think, Anon.
Probably. Could you complete the quotation? A frog he would a wooing go. Hey ho, says Rowley.
Whether his mother would let him or no.
Yes, with?
A roly-poly, gamelan, spinach, hey-ho, Stanton, and
yes, that's quite right. Well done. I think it's poor marks. Nursery rhyme, which was put to music and sung by the great clown Grimaldi, published about 1809, the title of The Lovesick Frog, but it comes in a very much earlier collection by Thomas Ravenscroft in 1611. And Anne Scott James got the finish of it quite right. Now, Frank Muir. 'Twas on a Monday morning, right early in the year, that Charlie came to our town, the young chevalier.
This is a thinly disguised Jacobite poem. Of Scottish origin. And it goes on, Charlie is me darling, me darling, me darling. Charlie is me darling, the young chevalier.
Quite right.
By Robert the Burns.
No, it wasn't, you know.
It was by... Eh?
It's frequently attributed to him.
All those apostrophes, it must be.
It ought to be, I agree.
The only other Scottish poet we know is Scott.
What about the Ettrick Shepherd?
Oh, Hogg. Doesn't Hogg.
That's right. Well, I helped you again. 3 out of 4. Frank repeated it quite right, so I won't. There is a dispute about this. It's often been attributed to Burns. It isn't Burns. It was put down to Hogg, and probably was. In Jacobite Relics of Scotland, he printed it. But also there was Carolina Lady Nairn, who lived almost exactly the same time, and a version is attributed to her as well. So they can share it between them. 3 out of 4. Well, the next round is a round of phobias. 2 marks. I want to know, what are people frightened of in the following phobias? And we begin with Dilys Powell. Cynophobia. C-Y-N-O, and then phobia. Cynophobia.
I mean afraid of dogs.
Exactly that. It means fear of dogs. 2 marks.
Afraid of Qatar.
Dennis Norden. Taffy phobia. T-A-P-H-E, and then phobia. Taffy phobia.
Can't be Welshman. They wouldn't, I don't know. Never heard of it.
Oh, come on, yes. Tombs.
Oh, is it? Good. Tombs. Fear of the tomb. This way to the tomb. The other way to the tomb.
Yes, the other way to the tomb.
Yes, he points, turn the arrows around the other way.
Not quite right. The origin of it, N has got quite right, but it isn't quite fear of the tomb as such. It's something on the nostril, and it happens a lot in the works of Edgar Allan Poe.
Oh, being buried alive.
Being buried, yes.
That's it. It's fear of being buried alive, though the Greek word really does mean fear of the tomb. Anne Scott James, photophobia.
Oh, fear of the light.
Absolutely right. 2 marks. And Frank Muir, clinophobia. C-L-I-N-O, and phobia. Clinophobia.
Clino. It's a Greek word.
Yes.
Second half means fear of. Clinophobia. To decline is to refuse. So cline. Clinophobia is the morbid fear of blowing a fuse.
The word is cliny.
The fear of an unknown...
Bits.
Yes.
Fear of an unknown
bits.
Greek
That's
word.
Fear of bits.
Fear of bits. Nobody fears those. Do they these days? It's fear of beds.
The odd thing is you're quite right. It's being terrified of going to bed.
Actually, H.G. Wells wrote a whole book about this, didn't he? About the various sleep problems. Kips, you mean?
And now we come to the last round and go back to the quotations I gave the 2 teams earlier on in the programme. For 2 marks, Dilys Powell, will you give me the origin of your quotation, which was, "Someday I'll find you."
The song, Jack.
Yes?
It's a song, and I think it's by Noel Coward.
Yes, and do you happen to remember in which work it comes?
Well, I associated with Private Lives.
Oh, you're absolutely dead right, and you get 2 marks for Noel Coward's Private Lives, a song, "Someday I'll find you." And now, Anne Scott James, the origin of your quotation, a longer one. "How sharper than a serpent's tooth it is, to to have a thankless child?
I think this is King Lear.
Yes.
Well, was this before or after he discovered that Cordelia was the good one and Goneril and Regan were the bad ones? That's the point.
It's unfortunately in the middle, before he was certain about Cordelia.
Where the commercial comes.
You've got to have a bet on which particular daughter it was.
Which do you think it was?
The nastiest one.
Regan was the nastiest one.
Yes, you're right. I'm sorry, I've misled you. I didn't mean to.
Oh, then it's Goneril.
Yes, it was. I think just one and a half, because I helped a bit and misled a bit.
One and three quarters for being misled. No.
It's towards the end of Act One. Lear has turned up at Goneril's house with an enormous number of knights on horseback, and she's being very, very bad about it and says he must go away unless he comes back with very much less than that number, because there are too many to feed. Well, now I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanations of how these quotations came into being, and on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever unlikely explanation receives the longer amount of applause from the audience here in the theatre. And so, back to Frank Muir and his quotation, "Someday I'll find you."
Someday I'll find you. I can see the record now. Rather thick they were in those days. About the size of a pancake, really. Black. It was my first love, really. First love, you know, falling in love for the first time, is rather like treading on a bit of broken glass when you're bathing. You don't feel the pain till afterwards. There's always a little scar left on your soul. I was 14 at the time, and I had a tent on the beach at Broadstairs, and I used to sit there and play my records and sleep. And then I suddenly found that my sleep was being disturbed by a noise from the next tent. It was a curious sort of chunk, chink, chump, chump, chaff, chunk, chunk, chump, 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 chink, chink. This went on for a couple of days. At the seventh day, I found it was a girl eating. She was a French girl. Her name was Clementine. She was about 14. Stone, not years. She was older than me. She was about 15 and a half years. A lot of puppy fat, a couple of litters full of puppy fat. And after a while, she started talking to me. She talked a lot, said how she'd come over to learn English. She spoke English very well. And then she invited me one day back to her digs. She and her sister had kind of digs in one of those big Victorian houses, and fed me. And suddenly these two French girls, they produced food I'd never met before. A marvellous thing they did, where they got some beautiful French cheeses, Camembert and Gruyere, and melted them down in a bowl, and then we laughingly dipped pieces of toast in and whisked it out and ate this hot cheese. Straight fondue, they called it. Absolutely wonderful. Well, this, of course, increased my love for her. She had opened a new sensual world to me of eating. So, a week later on the beach, I decided that it was time I did something with this girl. So I wrote a letter to her and pushed down to the tent flap. I said, "Please, I'm going to do one of those fondue cheese parties next samedi. And j'espère que you will come along to my fondue party à la maison de my mum." But I then had to go away to visit an aunt, and I wouldn't be back till the Saturday. And I knew that Clementine was very absent-minded, so I left her a reminder, and I couldn't think of anything to write on. I suddenly saw this gramophone record of Noel Coward's, and I got a bit of chalk from the cliff, and I wrote on it in a reminder, "Don't forget, I'm seeing you Saturday at the cheese party," and I pushed it under her tent flap. Came the Saturday, I went out and I bought 4 pounds of cheddar cheese, and I boiled it up in this saucepan, and she arrived. Then I realized that English cheese isn't like French cheese. It wasn't working with the cheddar cheese. She pulled it out and it sort of coagulated. It got stiffer and stiffer. I pulled mine. It went like sort of yellow rubber. Now, Clementine was a hungry girl and wasn't going to give up. So she braced her feet got the strand of this over her shoulder and marched forward. Further and further this yellow rubbery thing stretched till eventually it gave. Of course, the recoil was enormous. The yellow cheese flashed out, wrapped itself round her neck, coiled right round her body. There she was, inert, out from shock. I didn't know what to do. I rolled her outside. I balanced her stiff body on the crossbar of the bike and pedalled her to Margate General Hospital, where they cut her free with wire clippers. 2 weeks later, she returned to France, 5 stone in weight, with a permanent allergy to food. And the only memento of my first love was I still have that gramophone record of Niall Coward and the chalk message I'd written on it reminding her. Just a little simple phrase. I'd say, don't forget, Saturday at the cheese party. But I'd written it in my schoolboy French. I'd written, Samedi à la fondue.
Now we go back to Dennis Norden, and if you remember, his quotation was, how sharper than a serpent's tooth it is to have a thankless child.
If I were to say to you people sitting here that for the past 12 years I have consistently diddled the income tax, you wouldn't look on me as a criminal, would you? Do you know, I found out that there are people who look on me as a criminal for doing that. And I tell you what people they are. They're the income tax people. Now, I, as it were, came to income tax rather late in life, having made several false starts. But when I came out and I said, well, I'll do it all right now and I'll pay income tax. And by this time I had a family, I had 2 children. And I sent for one of their forms. I mean, I volunteered. Most other people are conscripted into this. I volunteered, and they sent this form, and it said, how much do you earn, which I put down, and it says, claims, the things that you want allowances for, and it said things like, do you have children? If so, state numbers. Now, that's a silly thing, because our children haven't got numbers. We gave them names, you know. And I had 2, and I was just about to write it when I suddenly remembered something that a chap I know, is a very smart businessman, had told me, and he said that whatever you claim for on the income tax, they always cut it by half. So I thought, well, I'll take advantage of this, and I put down 4 children. Reckoning, of course, that they would then pursue their usual course and give me allowances on 2. But they didn't. For 12 years, they gave me allowances for 4 children. Till this couple of months ago, when there was this knock on the door, and there was this chap, and he said, good morning, I am the new local tax inspector, and I am calling round inspecting the members of my parish. Bang! That was the door being shut. I rushed through to the kitchen to my wife, and I said, quick, I must have 2 more children. This is imperative. The man is outside. He thinks we've got 4 children. We've only got 2. I should be sent to prison unless you find 2 more children. Where can I find 2 more children? She said, well, there's that Boy Scout. Now, that was a bit of luck, because it was Bob a Job Week, and this weeny little chap had come round in the Boy Scout uniform and said, is there any tiny domestic chore I can do for you, and you will give me a shilling? And I said, yes. And I had him building this 16-foot wall. Well, I reckon that'd keep him clean in thought, word, and deed for a little while. So we got this kid, and we hoiked him into the living room with our 2, sat them down there, and I said to my wife, now go and find another child. She said, where? I said, anywhere. Go to any of the neighbours and just borrow a child. So he said, right. Out she went through the back door. I went to the front door, opened it to this chap, said, terribly sorry. I said, but I had to tidy up because we live so simply and economically, husbanding every penny, And he came and said, splendid, and so on, sat down and said, this is my little family. And he looked, and his face suddenly grew tight, and he said, there are only three children. I said, my wife has got the other one out for a walk. She'll be back in a minute. Bang, bang, bang on the door. Went to the front door. There's my wife with this child. And she says triumphantly, this is our fourth child. Well, of course, that did it. That's what blew the gaff. I mean, he was on to it immediately. He'd be a fool if he wasn't, you know. And it really was stupid. I mean, she had the whole of the neighbourhood to choose from, and she had to go to number 42 and take their child. I mean, I've got nothing against the family. They are charming people. They work for their embassy. We've had a lot of wonderful meals there. And I adore fried rice and crispy noodles. But every time I think of it, I just go puce. Out of the whole street, how sharper than a serpent's tooth it is to have Ah Fang Lee's child.
Well, that brings us to a final score, because by your vote, Dennis Norden just wins in the contest of stories. A final score in which Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden win by 2.5 marks from Lillis Powell and Frank Muir. And it also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Lillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The programme was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC. ¶¶